Chapter 9 of Book 3. These supernatural apprehensions of the memory, if esteemed, are also, for spiritual persons, a decided occasion for slipping into some presumption or vanity, since anyone not receiving these is liberated from falling into this vice, because nothing within him warrants this presumption. So on the other hand, anyone receiving them will be exposed to the idea that he is now worth something on account of these supernatural communications. Though indeed a person, in considering himself unworthy, can attribute them to God and be thankful for them, yet there are usually remains in the spirit a certain hidden satisfaction and an esteem both for the communication and for oneness. Consequently, without one's realizing it, an abundant spiritual pride will be bred. This is quite evident from the displeasure and aversion these individuals feel toward anyone who does not laud their spirit nor value their communications, and from the affliction they experience upon thinking or being told that others receive the same favors or even better ones. All this is born of hidden self-esteem and pride, and these persons are not fully aware that they are steeped in pride. They think that a certain degree of knowledge of one's own misery is sufficient, yet at the same time they are full of hidden self-esteem and satisfaction, more pleased with their own spirit or spiritual goods than with those of their neighbor. They resembled the Pharisee who thanked God that he was not like other men, and that he had the various virtues, and who, from the thought of these virtues, derived self-satisfaction and presumption. Luke 18:11-12. Though they may not express this as the Pharisee did, they habitually feel this way in their spirit. Indeed, some become so proud that they are worse than the devil, since they observe interiorly some apprehensions and devout and sweet feelings which they think are of divine origin. They become self-satisfied to the extent of thinking that they are very close to God, and that others who are without them are very far from God. And like the Pharisee, they look down upon these others. To avoid this pestiferous evil, abhorrent in the eyes of God, they should consider two truths. First, virtue does not consist in apprehensions and feelings of God, however sublime they may be, nor in any similar experience. But on the contrary, it comprises what they do not experience, that is, deep humility, contempt for themselves and for all things, very explicit and conscience to the soul, delight that others feel contempt for them also, and the desire to be worth nothing in the hearts of others. Second, all the visions, revelations, and feelings from heaven, or whatever else one may desire to think upon, are not worth as much as the least act of humility. Humility has the effects of charity. It neither esteems nor seeks its own. It thinks no evil save of self. It thinks no good of self but of others. Consequently, souls should not content themselves with these supernatural apprehensions, but strive to forget them for the sake of being free. Chapter 10 of Book 3. It can be deduced and easily understood from all we have said how much evil can come from the devil by way of these supernatural apprehensions. He can present to the memory many false ideas and forms under the guise of truth and falsehood. This he does through suggestion, by impressing them on the spirit and the senses in a very efficacious way. He makes these ideas seem so certain that a soul thinks they cannot be false, but that what it feels is in accord with truth. Since the devil transforms himself into an angel of light, 2 Corinthians 11:14, he seems to be light to the soul. But this is not all. In the true visions from God, he can also tempt it in many ways, by causing inordinate movements of the spiritual and sensory appetites and affections towards these visions. If the soul is pleased with these apprehensions, it is very easy for the devil to occasion an increase of its appetites and affections and a lapse into spiritual gluttony and other evils. To accomplish this more expertly, he usually suggests and places pleasure, savor, and delight in the senses relevant to the things of God, so that sweetened and dazzled in that delight, the soul may become blind and fix its eyes more upon the pleasure than the love, or at least not so intensely on the love, and pay more attention to the apprehension than to the nakedness and emptiness of faith, hope, and love. And in so doing, the devil deceives the soul little by little and readily makes it believe its falsehoods. To a blind soul, falsehood no longer seems falsehood, and evil no longer evil, for the darkness appears to be light, and the light darkness. Isaiah 5:20. On this account, the soul will fall into 1,000 blunders in matters natural, moral, and spiritual, and what was wine will have turned into vinegar. All this comes about because of failure to deny the pleasure of those supernatural apprehensions from the beginning. Since the satisfaction is slight, or not so evil at first, the soul is not careful and allows it to remain, so that, like the mustard seed, the evil grows into a large tree. Matthew 13:31-32. As a saying goes, a slight error in the beginning is a great one in the end. To flee from this gross error of the devil, therefore, a person should be unwilling to take pleasure in these apprehensions, for most certainly this pleasure will gradually blind him and cause him to fall. By their very own nature, without the devil's help, pleasure, delight, and savor blind the soul. David indicates this when he said, "Darkness will perhaps blind me in my delights, and I shall have the night for my life." Psalm 138. Chapter 11 of Book 3. Little remains to be said about this fourth kind of harm, since we are explaining it all along in this third book. We have given proof that a soul must renounce all possession of the memory in order to reach union with God in hope. For if hope is to be centered entirely on God, nothing that is not God should reside in the memory. And we have also given proof that no form, figure, or image, or idea, whether heavenly or earthly, natural or supernatural, that can be grasped by the memory is God, or like to Him. Accordingly, David teaches, Lord, among the gods no one is like you. Psalm 85. If the memory, consequently, is desirous of paying attention to this knowledge, it is hindered from union with God. First, because of the encumbrance. Second, because the most possessions it has, the less hope it has. The soul, therefore, must live in the nakedness and forgetfulness of distinct forms and knowledge about supernatural apprehensions, so as not to impede union of the memory with God through perfect hope. Chapter 12 of Book 3. The fifth kind of harm derived from the desire of persevering in the memory, preserving in the memory, and imagination, these forms and images of supernatural communications is no less evil than the others, especially if the soul desires to use these images as means towards the divine union. It is extremely easy to judge the being and the height of God less worthily and sublimely than is suitable to his incomprehensibility. Though a person may not form an explicit idea that God is similar to these apprehensions, nevertheless they very esteem for them, if in fact he esteems them, produces in the soul an esteem and opinion of God less elevated than then giving in the teaching of faith, that he is incomparable, incomprehensible. Besides taking from God all this attention it gives to creatures, the soul will naturally form in its interior, through esteem for these apprehensions, a certain comparison between them and God. This comparison prevents it from having as lofty a judgment and esteem of God as it ought. Creatures, earthly or heavenly, and all distinct ideas and images, natural or supernatural, that can be the objects of a person's faculties, are incomparable in unproportion to God's being. God does not fall under the classifications of genus or species, whereas, according to theologians, creatures do. And the soul is not capable of receiving clearly and distinctly in this life what does not fall under the classifications of genus and species. Thus St. John affirms that no one has ever seen God. John 1:18. Isaiah declares that it has not entered the heart of man what God is like. 1 Corinthians 2:9. And God told Moses, "You cannot see me in this life." Exodus 33:20. Therefore, anyone encumbering the memory and the other faculties of the soul with what is comprehensible, cannot have the proper esteem or opinion of God. I repeat, therefore, anyone encumbering the memory and the other faculties of the soul with what is comprehensible cannot have the proper esteem or opinion of God. Here is a poor example. The more a person sets his eyes on the king's servants, the more attention he pays to them, the less heed he pays to the king, and the less he esteems him. Though this estimation is not in the intellect formally and explicitly, it is practically, because the more attention he gives to the servants, the more he takes away from his Lord. And then his judgment of the king is not very high, since the servant seems to him somewhat important in comparison with the king, his Lord. This is what happens in relation to God when a person pays attention to these creatures. Although the comparison is very inadequate, because, as we have mentioned, the being of God is different from the being of his creatures. God, by his being, is infinitely distant from all of them. The soul should consequently turn its eyes from these creatures so as to focus upon God in faith and hope. Those who not only pay heed to these imaginative apprehensions, but think God resembles some of them, and that one can journey to union with God through them, are already in great error, and will gradually lose the light of faith in their intellects. And it is by means of faith that the intellect is united with God. Furthermore, they will not increase in the loftiness of hope, the means for union with God in the memory. This union is effected by disuniting oneself from everything imaginative. Chapter 13. Like the observation we made concerning natural forms, the benefits from voiding the imagination of supernatural apprehensions can be ascertained through the five kinds of harm caused in the soul if it desires to possess these forms interiorly. But besides these, there are other benefits of deep spiritual repose and quietude. In addition to the tranquility a person naturally enjoys when freed from images and forms, there is a freedom from care about the discernment of the good ones from the evil, and about how one ought to behave with the different kinds. Finally, one would be absolved from the drudgery and waste of time with spiritual directors, which would result from desiring the director to discern the good apprehensions from the evil ones and to ascertain the kind of apprehension received. A person does not have to know this, since he should not pay attention to any of these apprehensions. The time and energy that would be wasted in trying to discern them can be employed in another, more profitable exercise, the movement of the will toward God. And in solicitude about the search after spiritual and sensory nakedness and poverty, the desire to lack all the consoling support of the apprehensions, both interior and exterior. A person practices this latter by desiring and striving after detachment from these forms, since he thereby receives the great gain of approaching God, who has neither image, form, nor figure. He will approach God the more closely, the more he withdraws from all imaginative forms, images, and figures. Perhaps your question will be, why do many spiritual persons counsel souls to strive for profit in the communications and feelings God gives, and to desire favors from him in order to have something to give him? Since if he gives nothing to us, we shall have nothing to give to him. And you will establish this with a text from St. Paul. Do not extinguish the Spirit. 1 Thessalonians 5:19. And also with one from the Canticle of Canticles, in which the bridegroom says to the bride, put me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. Canticle 8:6. For this seal is the certain apprehension. And all of this, you will say, according to your doctrine, must not only be unsought, but rejected and put aside, even though God bestows it. And that evidently, since God grants this gift, he does so for a good purpose, and it will be effective. You will add that we must not throw away pearls, and that it is a kind of pride to refuse God's gifts as though we are self-sufficient without them. In answer to this objection, our explanation in chapter 15 and 16 of book 2, chapter 16 and 17 in the present state of the text, must necessarily be kept in mind. To a great extent, the objection is answered there. We stated that the good resulting in the soul from supernatural apprehensions coming from a good source is produced passively, without any operation of the faculties, at the very moment these apprehensions are represented to the senses. It is consequently unnecessary for the will to act in order to admit them. As we have said, if a man were to desire to act with his faculties, he would, through his base natural operation, impede the supernatural which God is producing in the soul by means of these apprehensions, rather than derive profit from his own labor. But since the spirit of these imaginative apprehensions is given passively to the soul, he must maintain a passive attitude without application of his interior or exterior actions to anything.